This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A report this week from the News Service of Florida revealed that a hardline anti-immigration group worked with lawmakers to draft a bill aimed at banning so-called sanctuary cities. Meanwhile, the Sunshine State is touted by politicians as a low-tax, business-friendly environment, yet Florida Trend magazine reports lobbyists representing businesses ranging from rental car companies to theme parks are pushing for more tax cuts. So whether it's clamping down on immigration or lowering taxes, just how are the laws that shape life in Florida being written? I'm Matthew Petty, and today on Intersection, we'll take a closer look at the role of lobbyists in drafting laws. We're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252 and your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us is Ana Ceballos. She's a reporter with the News Service of Florida. Ana, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined in the studio by Jason Garcia, editor-at-large with Florida Trend magazine, and Chris Carmody, an attorney and lobbyist with Gray Robinson. Chris, thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning. Same job title.
Okay. Well, Ana, I want to bring you in first. Just talk to us a little bit about your reporting on the Sanctuary City Bill. First of all, there's a little bit of back and forth, is there not, about what exactly this group is, or these bunch of groups that were advising Joe Gruters or trying to influence the shape of this bill. They've been labelled hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but there's some kind of pushback on that. Just fill us in on what's going on there.
Right, just a little bit of pushback, right? Well, it all started with a records request. Right? I just really wanted to find out, you know, what the Senate was talking about regarding the implementation of this pretty controversial sanctuary city ban bill. And, you know, as I started reading emails, I saw one of the vice president of one of these pretty hardline groups. They call themselves anti-illegal immigration group rather than anti-immigrant. And, you know, their purpose is to put an end to immigration anarchy, they told me. And, you know, I started seeing that they were making suggestions in one of their emails regarding giving the Attorney General authority to file civil action against local governments if they don't enforce or fully comply with federal immigration authorities. And they were also sending them draft bills that eventually didn't make it into the final and current version of the bill, but, you know, they were still trying to get language in there. They were also sharing a controversial list of which counties and cities in Florida are considered sanctuary cities, or what they call anarchy cities. And that list made it into the official bill staff analysis, and that kind of brought a lot of heat for the senator sponsoring the bill. So it's you just see like back and forth as to how people are advising the senator to either have talking points or how to recommend pass certain language for, you know, to make it a little bit more digestible for some folks in the prosecuting business.
Mm-hmm. Just out of interest, Ana, which cities are on the list of anarchy cities? Like, is Orlando an anarchy city? I know it can sometimes be anarchy on I-4, but that's a different story, I guess.
Yeah, no, and that was the controversial part, right? Where it officially no city or county has enacted an official sanctuary city policy. There's no cities that have that in place, but this group, doing their own research, they're, you know, Leon County or Tallahassee, that they're considered a sanctuary city or a sanctuary county because there was one incident where at a county jail they didn't honor a judicial warrant, administration warrant from ICE, and they let an undocumented immigrant out of jail after he served the sentence. So that's sort of like their threshold for what is considered a sanctuary city. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone voted to make the city or the municipality a sanctuary city, but just the fact that they limited in some way, in one case or more, the release of an undocumented immigrant, past the 48 hours that they're required to do so, they're considered one.
Is is the way a bill is shaped and the influence that a lobbyist or a special interest group may have in it, whether it's a business group or a non-profit or a local government in some cases, is there always a paper trail? Like, does it always start with an email? Is it sometimes just a phone call? Is it sometimes hard to kind of tease out the threads of who is putting their oar into the way a bill is steered?
I think it's a little bit hard sometimes. You know, you have to know exactly what you're looking for at times. You need to know. Most of the times that I've encountered is when I'm trying to find the paper trail, there will be a paper trail, but no details sometimes, that because you'll see the email and it's like, hey, please call me, and then you don't have the transcript of mm-hmm. the phone call. And so you don't know exactly what they talked about. And so in this case, I have one very specific email that they went into very good detail, and the staffer for Senator Joe Gruters, who's sponsoring the bill, he acknowledged the email and said, hey, we put your language through bill drafting. So that was pretty explicit. But, you know, when I was trying to get more details out of them, I had to interview them, and they wouldn't talk about it. They said that they, you know, they kind of denied that they even had any involvement, even though there's a paper trail. So it's just, sometimes it's a little bit difficult to track the details, but there's always, you know, a call log, there's always some evidence of communication, but you need to know exactly what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. So you've now talked to the president, at least of one of these organizations. What did you hear from him?
Right. So he didn't make it into the story because he called me the day later. So yesterday, the president of FAIR, who is the controversial group behind the Anarchy City list, he told me, you know, that they were pretty upset that he actually told me he thought my story was fair, but
wait, he said your story was fair?
Well, he said that he thought it was more fair than what his PR person let out to be, mm-hmm. which I really don't understand. Maybe he was just talking to me and he just didn't want to say it to my face. I don't know. But he did say that his biggest pushback was against the Southern Poverty Law Center labeling them a hate group. Mm-hmm. They don't dispute anything regarding their conversations with the senator and their involvement with the push for banning sanctuary cities and what their involvement has been behind the scenes. But they are pushing back against the label of being called a hate group. And, you know, it's, you know, no one likes being all the groups that are listed in the Southern Poverty Law Center. I found that, you know, there's pretty severe pushback against all of that. Mm-hmm. And there's lawsuits. They filed a lawsuit against them saying that it's a conspiracy behind a false name and they're just, you know, trying to damage their reputation. That it's, they called it, the guy who sent Joe Gruters emails, he called the Southern Poverty Law Center a, quote, scumbag organization. Hopefully it's cussed. I don't know if that's a cuss word.
No, I think you evaded the dump button there. Keep going.
I'm good. So it's, you know, it's an emotional debate, not only with immigration, mm-hmm. but also when it involves Southern Poverty Law Center labeling someone, you know, a group with ties to white supremacists. It's always going to, you know, be a point of contention. And mm-hmm. so that's a lot of the backlash with my story has been regarding the hate group label and not so much the content that they actually had conversations with the senator.
Right. Just back to the notion of the way certain bills are crafted and, you know, how out in the sunshine, so to speak, that is, because Florida does have these laws about the way things should be done, government in the sunshine, and access to information. From your point of view, though, Ana Ceballos, is it really all that kind of sunshiny? Are all of these things easy to see, and is the sort of mechanism of how bills are crafted and written easy to understand?
For the most part, you know, the more you talk to people in the process, you know who the players are. You know, when you're at committee hearings, you know exactly, you know who's testifying, and but sometimes it's a little bit hidden. For example, the home rule fights, right? When the state is trying to prevent local governments from having their own regulations, it might be an organization lobbying for a big company, and you, it's not like you see the disclosure about this big pharma company lobbying against a specific regulation, but you will see the company that they hired, and sometimes you do have to dig a little bit, but, you know, Florida is a pretty good with records laws, and, you know, if you know how to navigate them, you can eventually find some really good transparency, I guess, in the process. But it does take some understanding, I guess. And I say this as a, you know, I've covered this for 2 years, so I still consider myself a little bit of a novice. But you can find stuff. I think the Sunshine Laws are working.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious to know, too, Anna, did you get some response from Joe Gruters to your latest story about the Sanctuary City Bill?
Well, he commented in the story. I haven't talked to him after, but he told me, you know, he thanked the group for their help or their participation, he said, and their recommendations. But he told me that they did not have any influence over the language that made it into the current bill, even though, you know, you can, I guess, yes, they did not file specific language sediment, but they did. The group's attorney did suggest a provision that is now on the bill. Mm-hmm. So he's being very careful with how he says they influenced him. But he does thank them for their help in talking with them.
Right. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Anna Ceballos. She's a reporter with the News Service of Florida about her report on the Sanctuary City Bill sponsored by Joe Gruters. Anna Ceballos, stay with us. And I want to bring Jason Garcia with Florida Trend magazine and Chris Carmody into the conversation. We'd like to hear from you too as well. We're talking about the role of lobbyists in crafting legislation, whether they're working on behalf of businesses, local government, nonprofits. Just how big a role do lobbyists play in helping draft those bills? And how aware of you are the influences of folks other than lawmakers in crafting the bills? How much more transparency do you want to see? The conversation can be joined by calling us at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Jason Garcia, staff writer with Florida Trend magazine. The latest issue, or online rather, you write about taxation in the Sunshine State, the efforts of companies including Avis Budget to get legislation through that would give one business at least, the rental car industry, a tax break. Just kind of tell me about the influence of at least that group on trying to shape this piece of legislation.
Yeah, that's a really great example of where you see how some of this stuff works. So the rental car industry is pushing for some legislation that would reduce its Florida corporate income taxes, and it's related to sort of changes made on the federal level. But what you see in that is in sort of classic bill form, there's no sort of reference to rental car companies or any specific company. But if you start to pull out some of the records, what you find is the idea comes from Avis, one of the largest rental car companies. And they've been working with actually Joe Gruters, who I think has like filed every bill in the Florida legislature this year.
Mm-hmm.
But so what the records have showed is that Avis has been supplying language for this legislation that Gruters' office has been having before filing changes or final legislation, have been running it by the Avis budget lobbyists to make sure they're okay with everything. And then we found different examples of them sending, you know, when Senator Gruters presented his bill, the Avis sent a prepared speech to him to give, and they included like a list of proposed or expected questions and answers and stuff like that. So you see them, you know, this is a really clear example of where lobbyists are helping to sort of coach a legislator through an issue.
Mm-hmm. The legislative session is only 60 days long, right? And I know there is a lot of work that gets done outside of session, but it isn't a lot of time to get a lot of laws passed. Does that have some influence on the way or the number of people who might be involved in trying to get a bill through or crafting the language in it?
I don't think that by itself does, because the session itself is 60 days, but it's not like they're only working 60 days of the year, right? So 60 days is the window that they can actually pass laws. It's not the window whether they can work on laws. So committees meet throughout the year. Work on legislation happens throughout the year. You know, when you're looking for these records, you certainly wouldn't just look during the window of legislative session. So
mm-hmm.
I think a factor here is term limits, right? So legislators are in office no more than 8 years, 16 years if they do a term and or if they do a run in both the House and the Senate. So you don't have many legislators that are sort of policy experts, particularly once you get beyond sort of like the high level sort of the social issues that everybody sort of feels passionately about. When you start to get into like the technical issues like tax policy, like tort policy, like regulation, there aren't very many legislators who know this stuff. So they end up the knowledge base gets outsourced to the professional staff and the lobbyists. So mm-hmm. the expertise driving a lot of this is very often the lobbyists.
And is there a bit of a revolving door too with lawmakers ending up in lobbying shops and vice versa?
Yeah, more than a bit of a lobbying or a revolving door, yeah. It is very common to see legislators become lobbyists. A few years ago, the magazine looked at this, and it was I don't have the stats in front of me, but it was something around the order of like one out of every 15 legislators ends up becoming a lobbyist.
Is there pushback to that then? I mean, are some lawmakers saying, kind of like with the idea about we need to have term limits in Congress because otherwise people get too comfortable in their roles and they are maybe more prone to kind of being influenced by outside sources. Do you get the same argument around folks kind of going into the lobbying business after they've served in the Senate or the House in Florida?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's an issue that gets talked about a lot because it gets covered because it's sort of naturally one that a lot of people sort of raise their eyebrows at, right? And there's legislation that gets filed just about every year that would impose different ethics restrictions. And it passes sometimes. I think there was maybe even a constitutional amendment that passed this year that increased. So like right now, for the longest time, there was a legislative ban. There was a ban. You couldn't lobby the legislature for 2 years after you left office. I think they raised that, although...
You mean they made the ban longer?
Yeah, that's right. There are all sorts of ways around that in terms of like it doesn't ban consulting or sort of like amorphous, strategic advice, that sort of thing. And then there is actually a pretty compelling counter argument to that sort of stuff in that you want to encourage people to serve, right? You want to make government – you don't want to make serving in government punitive. So the more you do to limit post-career options, the more sort of you make public service a less attractive thing. So you also sort of do have to weigh – you don't want people profiting off their public service, but you also don't want people choosing not to go into public service at all because it's going to turn around and limit sort of what they can do after the fact too. So it's sort of a distasteful practice, but it's also not sort of a clear one to clamp down on.
Right, and I guess it's not a full time job being a lawmaker in Florida. They don't get a full time salary.
Yeah, I think
so
I think
for it.
That's right. It's technically a part time legislature. It's interesting in that they work a lot. I mean, when you add in committee meetings, they're meeting throughout most of the year, but the salary is like $30,000. So very few people make a living off of a legislative salary.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the role of lobbyists in crafting legislation in Florida. I want to hear from you as well. The number is 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think there should be maybe a little more transparency? Are you concerned about the idea of the outside influence on the crafting of bills? Or is it just something that's part of the process of making law and something to be expected? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. We are at WMFE Orlando. Chris Carmody, attorney with Gray Robinson. What are some of the kind of ground rules about lobbying? Like when you go into this, what do you have to know, and what are some of the boundaries that you're like, okay, these are the red lines that can't be crossed?
Well, I think that, and good morning. I think that changes with legislator. I know you talked to Don a little bit about the paper trail. There are some legislators I work with that. They don't want a text. They don't want an email. You just need to come by their office and schedule a time.
Mm-hmm.
There are others who will freely text, freely email, take a call at any time of the day, weekend, what have you. And in some regards, I think the more they go through the process, the more guarded they become. And as Jason was talking about with this Avis bill, Senator Gruters he's actually filed 69 pieces of legislation, if you're wondering, Jason. I know you said a lot. It's the most.
Wait a minute. 69 pieces of legislation. Let's just take a pause on that for a minute. So considering the amount of work that goes into all of these pieces of legislation, you know something about how the sausage is made, right, Chris? I mean, that seems a little bit crazy. Why is he on so many of those bills?
Well, you'll have to ask him that. But I know he was felt liberated from leaving the House. And the House, as you know, a legislator can only have 6 pieces of legislation. They can have some repealer bills and some memorials, and they can co-sponsor, but 6 of their own babies, if you will, their own pieces of legislation. And when the Senate, there's no limit. So I think Senator Gruters was just excited. Him and Senator Perry have the reputation of filing a lot of bills. I think Senator Perry's not too far behind in that regard. But so when you have that many pieces of legislation, or even when you're in the House and you have just 6 of your own, you still do rely on the lobbyists for the information. So it would not shock me at all, and I don't think there's any too much heavy-handedness or over-dealing with this Avis example, that they're providing him the information, they're giving him the talking points. I think the public at large, and even us as lobbyists, count on the legislators to use their judgment. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, they do still rely on folks to provide information. But you talked about red lines. There are lobbyists out there, and I bet Jason and Anna have already met a few and know a few, that they skirt those lines quickly, but then they're not allowed back in those offices. I know certain legislators, they have a list of the following people cannot come visit with me, and their aides know it. And it's because they were lied to, and they can't trust that person again. So at least in my profession, it is always tell the truth. If you want to be good at what you do, and if you make a mistake, if you accidentally share information with a legislator that you later find out is not true, as much as it may be embarrassing or uncomfortable, if you want to do it right, you need to go back and check with them or staff and say, hey, I told him or her this. You know, I later found out that wasn't 100% accurate. Let me give you the right details. I just don't want him or her to think, you know, or be misled on this. And the same thing, a good lobbyist, I think, prepares your legislator if they're running a bill for you, or if you're just advocating them on a piece of legislation that they'll see in committee. You need to give them all sides of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
If they only hear the sunshine, they're going to be really disappointed with a lobbyist if they get to committee. And I think with Anna's example on this, the immigration sanctuary cities issue, if you told Senator Gruters that, everyone loves this, and now he knows better, but he shows up in committee and all these folks are showing up from Southern Poverty Law and others that telling him how ugly his bill is, that you will not like that. And so on these business issues, like what Avis is doing with perhaps some tax issues or other groups do on commercial real estate or what have you, if you're doing your job right, you need to give them all sides of the argument and let them know what, if you will, the bad guys are going to say about that piece of legislation. This way they come in with eyes wide open. But generally speaking, follow the rules. I mean, in the last couple of years under previous Speaker Corcoran, they instituted lobbyist registration on particular issues. So if I'm in the House, I can't. Most legislators are good about it. They won't have a conversation unless they've confirmed I've registered on that particular issue,
mm-hmm.
which if as Anna and Jason know, that tons of transparency now in that. Like even as lobbyists, we use it. We've got a bill that we're working. I'll go look up my bill every once in a while to see if anyone else is registered on my bill to find out if I've got an opponent or another supporter perhaps or someone monitoring it. But you have to register for all of those bills. It's not quite as the same in the Senate, but it's similar. And so there's quite a bit of transparency in the process. You can't legislate bad people from doing bad things, but you can put rules in place that at least make sure that the public and the press and even the other lobbyists can have a lot of information.
Right.
And compared to other legislators, I think we actually do have quite a bit of information in there. But going to your initial question, just tell the truth,
mm-hmm.
And be upfront. That's, I think, the biggest red line, is because the minute you don't do that is the minute you're not going to be welcome in that office, and they won't trust you on future issues, even if you are telling the truth on that issue.
Yep.
Yeah, Chris makes a number of great points there. They have the lobbyist registration stuff they've done. Florida does take a number of steps to try and add some transparency to the system. There are a lot of folks that work the system that are very good at sort of finding ways to keep themselves secret. One example that comes to mind that the magazine wrote about just a couple of years ago was Marriott's timeshare business was facing a class action lawsuit. And so they got the legislature to pass some language that basically retroactively tried to invalidate this suit. And there was some emails we found that way where one of the public records exemptions in the legislature that makes the process a little bit opaque is that bills in drafting are confidential. You can't see you can't see any legislation in the works until it is actually filed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this bill about to come out of drafting that Marriott wanted to get this language attached to. And what the email showed is the lobbyist was pressing the offices of the House and the Senate sponsor they were working with, like, let's get this language changed in drafting because I promise you, you don't want to present this as an amendment in public. And that's because, you know, the lobby said because it was complicated, but one of the reasons it was complicated because it was designed specifically to counteract an existing lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, you can find examples of that where people know where the curtains are that you can get behind to try and mask some of this, particularly when it's stuff that is charitably, it could be complicated to explain. Less charitably, it might be controversial, right?
Right.
And so people, there are lots of ways you can sort of try and sidestep some of these transparency mm-hmm. initiatives.
We're talking about lobbying and the role of lobbyists. Excuse me, Chris, I'll let you jump in a moment. Let me get this word in here. Lobbying and the role of lobbyists in crafting legislation. We want to hear from you as well, 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. And Louis, believe you've got some thoughts on the issue. Louis, what are your thoughts on kind of listening to this conversation, thinking about the way laws are crafted?
I'm very leery of lobbyists. I know you've got ALEC, which is a big Republican lobbying arm. And I'm fighting now Senate bills STB 7096, where they want to raise the threshold from 60% to 66% mm-hmm. for citizens' initiatives, which would basically, you know, they didn't like it when they were losing at 50%, so they raised it to 60%, and enough people got motivated and got the signatures and got it on the ballot, and then what happens now? You have the guys at the felons. A great point now with the felons. They want to make them pay for their prison time before they give them the right to vote. So they were so afraid of these extra 500,000, you know, African-American voters that are now eligible to vote. It's actually 1.5 million.
Right.
And so they're going to do anything they can to stop that. So they're charging them like $58,000. This is a modern-day poll tax. And so, I mean, people should be up in arms of this, especially – way more than 60% of the people voted to restore these guys' rights without any kind of shenanigans. And right now there's shenanigans going on to try to stop them to have the right to vote. The same with the ballot initiative. Oh, how dare we as citizens try to go around the state legislature when they're not doing what we think they're supposed to be doing. And so they want to stop that by going to 66%. Instead of 60% on a ballot initiative.
So I'm hearing from you, Louis, that you're kind of saying there should be more citizen input, and you're a little concerned about the way things are being done at the moment.
More citizen input, and don't try to subvert it once the input's actually voted on and approved.
Mm-hmm.
Don't turn around and try to stall it. They know what the voters wanted. They wanted them to be, once they are done with their time, they have their voting rights restored. Immediately, not paying, you know, we had one quote of a guy having to pay $58,000 because, well, that was what your prison time was. No, he was in prison, so he paid his dues. That was enough
right.
of a penalty in his life, was the time he spent in jail.
Right. So, Louis, thanks for your call. I'm hearing you loud and clear there. And just, I guess, a point of a little bit of clarification on the issue of, how the Amendment 4 gets rolled out. My understanding is that the legislature is trying to put some rules in place for how that gets done. And one of the things that obviously the Democrats in Florida are saying is that making part of that process, folks pay the fines and fees that were part of their sentence is kind of not in the spirit of the law. Some sort of back and forth on that. Chris, I know you had some points to make before. I want to let you get those points in, but I just wanted to come back to you for a moment, Ana Ceballos, and to ask you that question about what happens, you know, when lobbyists go off the rails. I mean, Chris was talking about the red lines that can get crossed, and everybody knows who the bad lobbyists are. Is there like a kind of a place where if you want to get some shady lobbying done, you know to go to?
Well, I don't know about that, but I guess to his point, I there is evidence, right, of when they're trying to be honest and just try to warn the senators ahead of time. Like, again, going back to this one story, you know, they're in the email, they did write, like, hey, FYI, don't share this sanctuary city list widely because it can cause you problems. And it did, you know, and it's so it's just kind of like that relationship that you see with trust. I don't know about the shady stuff. I guess I haven't. I don't know exactly where to find that. Let me know if you do, because I would love to cover that. But I guess the relationships sometimes are clear, and how they kind of just interact.
Mm-hmm. Chris Carmody, Jason was making some points before about sort of, you know, people do know where those curtains can be drawn back and where people can have more influence. Has there been sort of any change in the way those rules are enacted, or, you know, the rules around the kind of lobbying you can and can't do in recent years? Or has it been pretty much set from the get-go, at least in your experience?
So there's what Jason was talking about with drafting is a great point, is when a bill's still in drafting, as much as lobbyists or reporters or others would love to find out what's in drafting, that is kept confidential because they don't all make it into bills. But, you know, in the last maybe 4 to 6 years, so three cycles, if you will, through the election process, there's been a cutback on, well, there's been more rules put in place, and he was right about the lobbyist ban. It's 6 years now, not 2 years. So I call it the Lobbyist Protection Act because now I don't have to compete against my legislative friends. It used to be, when I first started in the process, there were lobbyists who made their entire living on putting amendments on bills on the final day of session on the floor of the House or Senate that no one really had a chance to read, because it wasn't kind of where we are now, where something gets published and all of us can read it online on Lobby Tools or another service like that. It was, you had to either go to the print shop to get it and read it quickly. So did the legislators. And a lot of times, a lot of stuff would pass on days 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, and 60, and no one knew about it until weeks later. I'll give the House and the Senate credit. They've really done a good job of curbing those kind of amendments. They still occur, but when they now occur, they're a little more transparent, and everyone has a chance to read it because there's so few of them. Whereas, I kid you not, I remember my first year lobbying, I didn't understand it because I still kind of learned the ropes, but I mean, just amendment after amendment after amendment was being done on the floor, no questions being asked. And as long as you trusted the person offering the amendment, it sailed through. And you would see these lobbyists leaving, and sometimes their clients of special interest, if you will, leaving the House or Senate galleries, like high-fiving, because they know they had just snuck something through. And I remember, like, I as a guy who appreciates sports and just in general winning, like, you're like, okay, good for them, I guess. They just had a win there. But you also had to wonder what just got in there that they're so excited about. That does not happen near as much, if at all. And some of it's just because they've curbed that. And I would say, as a lobbyist, that's a good thing. Because lobbyists as well, we have to monitor amendments constantly on behalf of our clients to make sure something's not being filed that slips in, something that would be onerous to our clients as they have needs. So that process, it's good, and it's made it harder to slip things through. But again, if you want to, whether a lobbyist, special interest, or a legislator, if you want to push something through, there's always going to be, you know, shady corners or cracks that can be slipped through, no matter what the process is. I mean, you can make a lot of analogies to sports.
Right.
They always say, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. And you know, that people say the Patriots, and maybe your phone's going to light up when I say that, but they refer to them a lot when you say that. But you should always be trying to give your clients an edge. And as lobbyists, we all are competitive and type A personalities. But it's that fine line we all must try to walk of, yeah, this would give my client an edge, but is it ethically right? Am I doing the right thing here? Would they be okay if they knew I was doing that on their behalf? So you have to be mindful of that, because it's not sports. It's democracy. It's civics. It's your government. And so people have to be mindful of that. But yeah.
Right. And it affects the lives of Floridians. I want to get another call in here, if I could. Valerie, you're on the air. What's on your mind thinking about this?
This is Valerie.
Yes.
From Orlando.
Yeah, go ahead.
I really don't believe that there should be lobbying of any type allowed at all. I mean, the previous person you were speaking to proved my point exactly. They're getting paid by a special interest to skew the results in a manner that benefits their client. There's nothing fair about that. There's nothing about that that smacks of special interest getting what they want. through paid influence. And I don't believe there's any place for that in government. If a lawmaker wants information on a particular issue, let them get that from an unbiased source. There is no reason that lobbying should be allowed. This is why things end up in the bill on the back door.
So you're saying loud and clear, no lobbying. Valerie, thank you so much for your call. Jason, a question on that then. I mean, the number of bills that are getting filed, and obviously Joe Greer's being a point in case in point, rather, 69 bills. Could he write all those bills himself? I mean, there's like a team of people working on them, and there may be some sort of outside influences there, whether they're paid and interested in that regard or not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess sort of like, is it physically possible that he could write them himself? Yeah, I guess technically. But I mean, the reality is no. I mean, when you're dealing especially with a part-time legislature, and there's a professional staff in the legislature as well, but it's a fairly small staff when you consider the volume of stuff they're dealing with. I mean, it's a state of 20 million people. The reality is they do have to rely on other people's expertise. There's no way Joe Gruters can be a lawyer-level expert on immigration policy, tax policy, regulatory policy, and all that stuff. So, I mean, it's natural for them to turn to outside experts. I think what you'd hope to see is as much transparency in who they're relying on, where their information is coming from, that sort of thing.
Well, Jason Garcia with Florida Trend Magazine, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Ana Ceballos. She's a reporter with the News Service of Florida. Ana, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Chris Carmody, attorney and lobbyist with Gray Robinson. Chris, thank you as well.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, new music from Brian Malpass and Billy Jones. Stay tuned for that. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Three nights a week, you can catch singer-songwriter Brian Malpass honing his craft at Disney Springs. Sometimes he's leading the crowd in a sing-along of a 90s classic like Zombie or You Oughta Know. But Malpass is also making a name for himself with originals from his new album, Change the Room. Malpass joins us in the studio. He says he took a slightly different tack to write the title track from his album.
Most of the time, you know, you're writing songs about personal experiences and things like that. But this one of my friends was getting married, and he wanted me to play his wedding, and he wanted to hear a really popular song. And I was like, hey, you know, there's probably like a million people doing that right now, so maybe we should do something else. And I convinced him to write a song, but he's not really a musician. He's more of owns his own business. So he wanted to do it, so he sent me a spreadsheet of like where they met, what their favorite things to do, really cool stuff. We got together and literally wrote the song about them, for them, and produced it, recorded it. And when she walked out, she was thinking she was dancing to that real popular tune, and it ended up being the song that he ended up co-writing for her. And it went over super, super well. And I ended up liking it so much that I asked him if I could release it, and he loved that idea, and here we are.
Does he get a writing credit?
I would give him a writing credit, yeah. Right. Absolutely.
Kid outside of Fairfax, no one ever had my back like you, like you. Snowed in you and me, Game of Thrones, stand up to the break of dawn, that I'd find you. Being stuck inside, never felt so right. Warmth of your body right next to mine. Never thought I could be so lucky with your arms around. Sweet thighs so bright, these city lights got nothing on you, nothing on you. These buildings touch the sky. They can't sing me high. We're
Made it through the Upper East Side. We had the time of our lives. Just us two. The city life might have been a strain. I wouldn't change a single thing about me and you. No space inside, never felt so right. With the warmth of your body right next to mine, never thought I could be so lucky with your arms around.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're with Brian Malpass and Billy Jones. Brian Malpass on guitar, Billy Jones on cajon.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Our pleasure.
Are you a Game of Thrones fan as well?
Well, of course. I mean, I love Game of Thrones. And that was actually that lyric there. Their first date was they got snowed in and they spent the whole night. They just watched Game of Thrones and I think ate pizza, I believe. I think that's what he said. I can't remember. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. That's a lyric. Mm-hmm. Got to put that in there.
And me and my girlfriend just finally got cut. No spoilers, but just finally got caught up on the episodes. We've just been binge watching. And man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so this song now has a deeper meaning for you too.
Well, especially now today, yeah, I guess.
How do you normally go about writing songs? Do you and Billy kind of sit down and write them together? Do you write them yourself? How does
sure.
it work?
Actually, you know, it's all sorts of things. Like, I've been lucky enough to have some friends out in Nashville and got to write with lots and lots and lots of people. We've, you know, just all sorts of ways. You know, it's cool going into a room and meeting somebody that you've barely ever met, and then you're writing songs with them and learning things, and yeah, so how you go about it is going to be really different depending on who you're with.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like him and our buddy Micah, who actually went to high school with, they'll have like a track done and just have me come in at the end, and it's fully just everything, like they got on a roll and wrote it, and then I'll just come in and lay the full drums down on it. So yeah, like you said, there's multiple, I guess, ways to go about the the writing system.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, Change the Room was an example because me and Mike actually wrote that one, and then Billy came in and knocked it out at the end, which was super cool. It's just all sorts of ways.
Do you sing as well?
Not well.
No.
Yeah, not in shows, but at home I have my moments.
Fair enough. How would you describe your sound? Because to me it sounds a little bit country-ish.
Sure. That's the million-dollar question, right? Like you, as an artist, you strive to find yourself, and that's always the hardest thing to do. So describing it is, I'm just going to start leaving it up to everybody else at this point. I'm just going to keep writing songs, and you know, I'm like, hey, this is what I sound like, and then hopefully, you know, maybe I'll get a genre before too long.
This album, though, there's so many different tracks that he sounds different on, which is it's cool. In our live shows, we do anything from, he grew up singing soul, so we do anything from soul to new, like, Drake and hip-hop and everything
sure.
in between.
Yeah, everything goes into the live show. You know, you're playing for the audience, so however whoever's there to listen to you, you're playing kind of that style.
So where are your songs getting traction? You mentioned before we got started on the interview that you're getting a lot of hits on Spotify.
Yeah, so which was really surprising because we, you know, we're super homegrown. We play a lot, you know, both of us have been playing for a living since we were kid, 17 years old, you know, slept on couches and did that whole thing. And I used to live in North Carolina, got moved here to Florida. And we just played so often, I think we just kind of gained like a really awesome fan base. Like the people that follow us are phenomenal. And it may be small, but I think we're close to 40,000 plays in a month and a half or so. It was pretty good because we don't have any promotion. We're not paying for anything. This is solely people just listening, which is really, really, it's, you know, humbling. Mm-hmm. It's awesome.
So tell me a little more about the album. Where can people buy it, and are you touring with it?
Sure. Okay. We play right now. We are every Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. We're at Disney Springs, and I was actually play Tuesday during the daytime there too, solo. But yeah, you can find the album there right now. Soon we're going to release it out on iTunes and whatnot. But the single "Change the Room" is on Spotify right now. So if you follow Brian Malpas, that would be really cool. And send us the follow, and we'll be going to release a new song. Hopefully we're going to play that one here in a minute too. This one's super brand new. Mm-hmm. And that one's going to be the next one that we put out online.
Okay, well, tell me about the next song you're going to play.
Sure, okay. So this next one is ridiculously new. One of my good friends out in Nashville co-wrote on this one. His name's Burton Collins. He's a phenomenal songwriter. Like, yeah, I think he's written songs for Reba McEntire and Celine Dion, and he's was a huge honor to have him on the song. And, yeah, it's called Wildfire. We're really excited about it.
Carolina nights, you make sparks fly. This heart of mine didn't know it was ready. You lit me up. I fell in love. God gave you to me. 'Cause baby, you're wildfire. Burning up when you hold me tight. You're so fine. Can't believe you're all mine. Feel the heat when it sees your lips. Every time we kiss like this, the flames burn brighter, shoot higher and higher, like a wildfire. Take my bed, your head, my chest, your cheeks, rose red. There's nowhere we need to go. I'm so consumed with love for you. You're all I need to know. This baby, you're a fire, burning up when you hold me inside. You're so time we kiss like this, the flames burn bright and shoot higher and higher, like a wildfire, like a wildfire. So you can't live without, live without you. Baby, you're a wildfire, burning up when you hold me tight. You're so fine, can't believe you're all mine. Feeling it when it tastes your lips. Every time we kiss like this, the flames burn brighter, shoot higher and higher, like a wildfire, like a wildfire. Like a wildfire, like a wildfire.
Brian Malpas and Billy Jones with Wildfire, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
For sure. Brian Malpas's new album is called Change the Room. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for today's show from Juan Gualda and Emily Lang. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.